Within a grassland context, one of the things that is true almost globally is that nitrogen is often the most limiting nutrient to production of grasslands. And for those of your listeners who, purchase fertilizer and specifically purchase nitrogen fertilizer, they know that to compensate for that nitrogen deficiency that is very common in grasslands is quite expensive. So clearly, one of the key advantages and well-known advantages of legume is their ability to take nitrogen from the atmosphere, which is in a form that plants cannot access, and convert it into a form that can be used.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Lynn Sollenberger. He is a Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Agronomy from the University of Florida. He retired in July of 2025 and remains active in a volunteer role. Lynn, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. I'm happy to have you here with us today. Really excited about the conversation we're about to have. And before we dive into that, I want to ask if you can share with us a little bit about your background and your path.
Thank you very much, Leo. It's a privilege to be with you today, and I look forward to our conversation. So I am a native of the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States. Pennsylvania is where I grew up. It was the fourth generation of Sollenbergers on a family dairy farm in South Central Pennsylvania. And the origins of that farm dates back to my great-grandfather, who built the house that I grew up in and the barn that still sits on that property in the early 1880s. So my roots are firmly and deeply planted in agriculture, initially from a production standpoint, and then, of course, later academic and research standpoint. I did an undergraduate degree in biology, and then I went to Penn State University, where I did a master's in agronomy. And it was at Penn State that I started working in the area of forage crops and grasslands. From Penn State, then I came actually to University of Florida and did my PhD here. And it was never necessarily part of the specific plan I had, but while I was here, the position that I have held during the course of my professional career became available. And for reasons unbeknownst to me, they hired me for that job. My children accused me of being not very creative. And so once I started that position, I stayed in that position for 40 years, four decades, and always found it exciting and had an incredibly enjoyable and meaningful and hopefully somewhat productive career.
That's fantastic. And well, I know you just recently retired, but could you share with us a little bit about some of the projects, some of the last projects that you were involved with, when you were still at UF, and now that you continue in a volunteer role, what types of projects are you working on and what topics are you exploring?
Right. So my position here is teaching and research, and I teach four different courses related to grassland science, grassland research. And then over the course of my career, I've had an active research program, a significant part of which was graduate student training. And so working with graduate students has always been really a highlight of my days, and the opportunities that were presented in that area have been extremely valuable and meaningful to me. over the course of a 40-year career, you can imagine that the topics of research changed a bit. And some evaluation of new forage types that had not previously been used in Florida. And we actually continued that as an element of the research program throughout the time period that we were here. In Florida, most production systems are based on grasses and with livestock production systems. And so a lot of the work that we did early on was with grass monocultures and grass-based. Over time, I became much more interested in legumes. And so we've done quite a bit of work looking at integrating legumes into grasslands. We have also delved into the topic over the last 10 or 15 years of ecosystem services of grasslands. And so really over the last decade and a half or so, those themes of ecosystem services and the potential for utilization of legumes in grass-based systems.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lynn. And so you mentioned here, you know, a couple of different areas you've been working on in terms of integrating legumes and grasslands. And also you talked about ecosystem services. So I want to dive a little bit more into that. First off, can you explain to us what does ecosystem service mean? And why are they an important area of research?
So perhaps providing some context is useful, specifically because the area of my research is with grasslands. And so it's important to understand the scale of grassland agriculture and grasslands in general as a type of ecosystem across the globe. Grasslands are the predominant, the largest ecosystem in terms of great, occupy about 40% of the Earth's terrestrial ice-free surface. Now, that's an interesting number, but sometimes I have difficulty kind of conceptualizing what that looks like. And so if you think about the land area of the continental United States, the area of grassland is equivalent to 5 times that land area. So maybe that helps to just provide a picture of the scale of grasslands. So basically what that tells us is that anything that we do to those grassland systems is going to have a large carryover effect on Earth and the human population of Earth at large. So we're very interested in how we might then manage grasslands to provide ecosystem services. Now, getting to your specific question, the definition of ecosystem services is very simple. It's simply the collection of services or contributions that grasslands make to society. And you can apply ecosystem services to any kind of ecosystem or agro-ecosystem, if you will. So one of the things that, you know, you talked about the span of my career in these 4 decades. When I first started, we were very inclined to think about production responses, how much forage we could produce, how many pounds or kilograms of animal live weight we could produce on a given area of land. So what were the agricultural outputs of a grassland ecosystem? And that is indeed one of the ecosystem services provided by grasslands. In fact, they're called provisioning services. But over time, we became much more aware that the story is a lot larger than that. And you and your audience are probably aware that there are some issues that have been raised in terms of concerns regarding livestock production systems in terms of their impacts on the environment. And we sometimes refer to those as disservices, potential negative impacts. But along with that, we have wanted to have a clearer understanding and to better quantify the services provided. And so just very quickly to summarize a few of those. So one of the things that grasslands do that many agroecosystems, cropping systems don't do, is they provide year-round cover of soil. And as we think about sustainability, conservation, and so on, cover is hugely important. It deflects and reduces the intensity of raindrops so that more rain is incorporated into the soil. It helps minimize soil erosion and nutrient loss to water bodies. So, you know, that above ground cover is really a critical feature that then contributes to delivery of higher quality soils, less soil sediment loss to water, so cleaner water. It also, in terms of the below ground context for grasslands, they have a very dense root system. We've done some work that showed that some of our grasslands actually have 2 to 4 times the amount of biomass below ground than they do above ground at a given point in time. Probably many in your audience are familiar with the U.S. Great Plains, and those soils are notoriously fertile with high levels of organic matter. Why? Because for long eras of time, they were grasslands, and all of that below ground biomass served to increase soil organic matter and contribute to those stakes for agricultural production, high organic matter, high water holding capacity, high nutrient holding capacity, and so on. So as we think about this idea of ecosystem services, it's not simply our traditional concept of forage for hay production or grazing. It's not simply livestock products in terms of meat or wool or whatever, but it's also these contributions that grasslands make to the environment at large.
Perfect. Fantastic. And so, you were talking about these ecosystem services, mostly from the grazing system component, more in relation to the plant aspect of that system, right? So now, you know, once we bring animals and perhaps some of the negative aspects that people have in mind when they think of the disservices, perhaps is more related to the animal component than the plant component, I would imagine. So when we bring that animal component into that grazing system, which is an essential piece of that system, how does that play a role into these ecosystem services or perhaps into the disservices as well?
So if we kind of start from the bad news side, we're familiar with producing methane as a byproduct of fermentation. And that methane is a potent, and so that is often one of the disservices that is highlighted associated with incorporating animals into the grassland context. To counter that a little bit, I would just add to what I said earlier about the kind of the nature of grasslands. And that is that a very high percentage of grasslands occur in areas that are not well suited for other types of agriculture. And in fact, for other types of land use. And so because of the fact that we can utilize ruminant animals to harvest the photosynthetic output of those grassland plants, we as a society can actually utilize those grassland areas that if we planted them to corn or soybeans or something like that, the soils would typically highly erode, or perhaps the environment is too wet or too dry or whatever for those annual crops. So to counter the argument of, well, if you add ruminants, you do this negative thing, clearly one of the issues is that you utilize them is by integrating ruminant animals into them, that product, and produce something that is human edible. Another key issue that people think about when they think about kind of mismanagement of animal agriculture on grasslands is if we overstock. And so high stocking rates that really kind of take away some of the advantages of grass briefly is another way. So then we end up with those hillsides that have deep ridges through them from erosion, and we have water in our streams and rivers because of runoff. So those are some of the kinds of disservices that to think about and approaching them from a management perspective to try to change them from disservices to services is part of the conversation and part of my interest as a researcher.
Fantastic. So basically, as long as we manage things correctly and understand the systems and respect their limitations, we can definitely enhance those ecosystem services when we bring the animal component into that plant component of the system, making sure that we're getting the most out of those ecosystem services from both plants and animals together.
Absolutely.
All right. So, one topic here that you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation was that you've worked with the integration of legumes into these grassland systems, these grazing systems that are dominated by grasses, at least initially in your career. So can you talk a little bit about that and just on the importance of incorporating these legumes into these systems and just, you know, what role they play and why are they important?
So growing up on a dairy farm in South Central Pennsylvania, use of legumes was something that I was very well acquainted with. And alfalfa was a huge part of the system within that context. When I moved south to Florida and working here, and it's true not only in Florida, but in many warm climate areas, there are fewer adapted legumes. And many of those systems are based on either grass monocultures or mixtures of grasses, but legumes play a very minor role in many of those systems. And in fact, in Florida, that has been the case starting about in the 1940s when, quote, improved grasses or cultivated grasses were incorporated into our production systems and facilitated a change from a kind of native rangeland pasture context to a planted pasture context. It has strongly been based on grasses. Those grasses are wonderful plants, and they contribute hugely to animal nutrition as well as ecosystem services, but they do have some shortcomings. Within a grassland context, one of the things that is true almost globally is that nitrogen is often the most limiting nutrient to production of grasslands. And for those of your listeners who purchase fertilizer and specifically purchase nitrogen fertilizer, they know that to compensate for that nitrogen deficiency that is very common in grasslands is quite expensive. So clearly one of the key advantages and well-known advantages of legume is their ability to take nitrogen from the atmosphere, which is in a form that plants cannot access, and convert it into a form that can be used. That has a number of really important implications. One, legume growth then is not strictly limited by soil nitrogen because they can fix their own nitrogen. Legumes can also provide significant amounts of nitrogen to the grass into which they are planted, whether that be release into the soil or consumption by animals who then excrete urine and dung onto that grassland that is higher in nitrogen than it would be otherwise because legumes are a portion of their diet. But also then legumes result in forage that is higher in crude protein, whether it be the legume itself or the associated grass. And also legumes are higher in digestibility. They can be more efficiently utilized by livestock than grasses at a comparable stage of maturity. So for all of those reasons, we're interested in getting legumes into the system. One other thing I might mention in that regard is that a general concept within grasslands and within agriculture at large is that increasing the number of species present can increases diversity, but it also increases resilience of a system. So agricultural systems are often under significant amounts of stress, and a more functionally diverse system can, one, tolerate that stress typically better, but also bounce back more quickly following a stress event than a system that is based on only one species. So adding legumes then effectively also adds resilience to the system. One thing I would talk about then is one of the challenges that we've had in getting legumes into systems is that historically, grasses that we use in planted pasture land originate in areas where they have been grazed by large herbivores for large periods of time. Think about the African savannas, for example. Not cattle necessarily, but large animal grazing. And a lot of the grasses, particularly the ones we use in warm climates, originated from Africa, some from South America. And the legumes, however, their points of origin were generally areas where they were less likely to be exposed to grazing by large herbivores. So grasses have adapted over time and developed mechanisms, growth habits that make them more tolerant of grazing. Legumes, on the other hand, not so much. And so one of the challenges that we faced is trying to match the growth characteristics of the grass and the legume so that they can be as compatible as possible, so that we increase the likelihood of being able to establish, develop, and maintain then these long-term persistent grass legume mixtures.
That's fantastic. Thanks for explaining that. I was actually, while you were explaining, I was thinking of this coming from perhaps a more row crop perspective where, you know, growers use cover crops for different purposes, but one of the ways of cover cropping is to actually have mixes, right? And having many, or at least two or more species of cover crop in the same mix. And something that we often see is that grasses, because they grow more aggressively compared to other species, you know, will likely dominate that mix, even though you start off with a mixture, but in the end, you may end up having most of that biomass coming from the grass species of the mixture. I was about to ask you about that. So I think you brought a very interesting point in terms of, you know, both the relationship of the legume and the grass with animal grazing, so with that external stressor, but also this component of competition between the grass and the legume as well, even if you were to remove the effect of grazing from that relationship, right? So I think this was a really interesting point, and I guess perhaps a follow up on this would be, you know, if you were to even just remove that grazing stressor from the equation, you know, how do these different species with different aggressiveness and how fast they grow, you know, what are some of the strategies that you have that a farmer can have when they're trying to make sure that they bring a legume that is not going to be, you know, outcompeted by the grass?
I teach undergraduates, and one of the things I tell them is that, somewhat tongue in cheek, but in any situation where you have multiple biological entities within the same environment, things get more interesting. And for them, I ask them to think about time periods in their life when they were in relationship and times when they were not, and which time period was more simple and which time period was more complex. And making the assumption that when they were in relationship, it was more complex, which has been my experience. So likewise, whenever someone is interested in formulating a mixture of grasses and legumes, it is going to make their life more complex. And just are not that interested in management. And in that case, just use the grass monoculture or a mixture of grass species, because it is going to take more attention to detail and more effort to maintain the legume with the grass. So you can think about that from a number of perspectives, but nutrient management is going to be a key piece to that equation. If you put a significant amount of nitrogen on, it's going to shift the balance of competition toward the grass and against the legume, because the legume is better suited to deal with a nitrogen deficiency, because it can shift, it can produce its own. The whole grazing equation, in terms of the height to which you can graze those species in a mixture, you have to think about both or all of the components of the mixture as you think about how you're going to manage the grazing. And so then it does also become more complex. And one of the other features that we experience in warm climates is that most of our grasses, being of subtropical and tropical origin, are what we call C4 grasses. And if those in your audience are not familiar with a C4 grass, it simply has a different photosynthetic mechanism than temperate grasses and legumes, and they're called C3 plants. The C4 grasses as a group are typically capable of, at least in warm temperatures, outgrowing their temperate colleagues. In Pennsylvania, we were growing a C3 like orchard grass or ryegrass or timothy with alfalfa. And so they were both C3s, had compatible photosynthetic systems. In Florida, southeast, tropics, subtropics, you're typically growing a C4 grass with a much more vibrant photosynthetic process than the legume. And so there's also that physiological piece that is working against you to some extent in keeping the legume present. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why we've had some challenges getting legumes into warm climate grass-based pastures.
Well, thanks, Leon. That was very well explained. Well, we're getting towards the latter part of our episode. And before we go there, I just want to invite our audience, if you're enjoying this episode, make sure to like, follow, share this episode with anyone that you think can also benefit from this great conversation.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
All right, Lynn. So the last three questions that we ask every guest. So the first one of them is going to be, if you have any resource you could share with us that you found to be very useful during your career on the technical side of things. So a resource more related to your technical expertise that you'd like to share with us.
For folks both in production and extension, and there's a book called Southern Forages. And this book has been around now for, I don't really know, probably 20, 25 years. The authors are renowned forage scientists in the southern U.S. And so if you're interested in a very non-technical description of technical themes, that's a great resource that my students, the county extension specialists I've worked with, and my fellow scientists have all found to be extremely useful. And it addresses a lot of the themes that we've talked about already.
Perfect. And just to make sure I got it right, so the name of the book is Southern Forages. Is that right?
That's correct.
Perfect. Fantastic. Thanks, Lynn. All right. Our second question of the three is very similar. So a resource you may have to share with us, however, outside of your technical area of expertise.
Right. And that one's harder for me because I tell people, so now that I've retired, I have time to read. I was a voracious reader when I was a kid. And when I became a scientist, I read all the time in terms of journal articles and students' essays. And but I had very little time to read outside of my discipline, or at least I seemed to have. One of the things I did occasionally throughout my career was delve into some of the more social science literature. And there's someone who, her name is Brené Brown, and you may be aware of her. She's pretty famous. But I've listened to some of her stuff, when I'm driving and, podcasts and audiobooks and so on. And she's been very useful in ways that I think about how I relate to my colleagues, to my family, and also and others. If you just Google her name, you'll find all kinds of resources. I would just point out one thing I learned. She talked about this phrase, N equals one. N equals one. As scientists, when we talk about N, it refers to the number of observations. And the point she was making when she talked about N equals one is that every new farmer, extensionist, student, you name it, person on the street that we encounter is effectively a sample size of one. They are unique. They have their own inherent characteristics and biases and opinions. And we, who are charged with working with them, need to be adaptable and willing to alter our preferred style to develop an effective way of interacting with them. So particularly in my dealings with students, they're not going to be like me, and I can't expect them to be. I wouldn't want them to be. So N equal one.
Nice. I love that concept. And I really like the fact that, as you said, it's something that as scientists, we're aware of what that N means in terms of just our data that we collect and that we make inference upon it. But yeah, I have not heard of the concept applied to just being adaptable to other people as well. So that I really appreciate you sharing that. All right. So our last question here is, what have you observed to be the key skills or skill sets that successful professionals have?
when I launch into this, you also have to remember that N equals one. That's in this case, it's just one person's ideas, right? I would start with saying that most successful people, I think, follow their passion. So I would encourage people to, and I talk to my students about this all the time, find out what you're passionate about. What is your reason for, you know, getting out of bed in the morning? You know, if it's cold and rainy, how can you get out of bed still with a smile on your face? Because you know you're going to jump into the middle of an ocean of your passion today. And so that's been a secret, I think, of mine, that I at least think that I'm passionate about my teaching, my research, my interaction with undergraduates and graduates and my extension talks and so on. So I think it all starts there. From there, then it becomes a bit more maybe individualistic. And so what I've found is that the most successful people doing what I do have characteristics of creativity. So they think outside the box. They think of solutions that other people might like. And then they also have the self-confidence and the discipline required to act on that creativity, to follow their gut, to follow their ideas to some logical conclusion. And the last thing I would say is, one person described me at some point as a relentless finisher. So some very creative people develop new ideas but get bored with them very quickly. I would say that if you're going to be successful, you need to be relentless in finishing what you've started.
Fantastic. Those are, I appreciate all that. And well, I myself have some manuscripts here just waiting to get out of my desk. I'll apply that very soon here to my own work.
We all do.
Well, then, this wraps up our episode. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I really appreciated our conversation, learning more about grazing systems, and especially, you know, in this case, you're, you know, learning from your story coming from Pennsylvania, going to Florida, and really developing this beautiful career. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. I really enjoyed having you today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun to have this conversation. I appreciate the opportunity.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.